You're listening to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to the Wharton Executive Education Podcast, hosted by Alex Gromatsky. And today we'll be talking with Andrew Davies, former CEO of SPOL. And that company is in the higher education software business. And Andrew recently exited that company. And now he is the Chief Investment Officer of Think Technology. So thank you, Andrew, for being on today. How are you doing?
Good. It's my pleasure, Alex. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. So Andrew, you recently exited your company, and I'm sure some of the details you can't get into, but what made you decide to, you know, exit your company? How did you know you were ready for the next chapter in your life?
Well, I have to credit Wharton Education for that. You know, prior to Wharton, I was very happy just running a business that made a few million a year and did well. But after going to Wharton, I really got my eyes on the prize of building a unicorn, something bigger, something with scale. So for a couple of years, I've been thinking about ways to either scale the business that I had or to, you know, exit and start a new business that I could scale. After several attempts to scale the business, I did very well. I got the growth rate to about a 30% CAGR, 35% CAGR. But I realized that I was going to have to start something new to really get my goals accomplished. So I can credit or blame the Wharton Education, Executive Education, for that exit. And really, it's they really teach you how to make billion-dollar unicorns, and that's what I'm looking to do next.
Well, you know, making a few million a year is already incredible. So how did you get into the higher education software and, you know, get into that role that you were in, and then end up in a position that you're selling the company and end up being, you know, financially successful?
Well, you know, I started my company back in 1997 as a consulting group. And I personally had gone through a lot of trouble finding money for college, specifically finding scholarships or getting in. So my very first software package was a scholarship management software package. And I built it in alignment with the college, who were acting as my sounding board to point me in the right direction. But mainly it was my desire to help students find funding and help underprivileged people get access to higher education. I exited that business in 2012. So that was my second exit. And then I used the money from that, the proceeds from that, to kind of push forward this idea of SPOL. And SPOL is about making sure that students get a solid education for the money they're spending. So my first step was, let's get the students the money. And then I realized that a lot of students going to some mainly private institutions were graduating without basic skills, or they were dropping out after taking out huge student loans. So I started SPOL as a way to make sure that schools were delivering on learning outcomes that were promised to students. And so that was kind of all wrapped up into making sure that students got a better education.
Wow, so it sounds like you started with, you know, facing or dealing with the problem you initially had, and then took what you learned from there and tried to just continue to improve and iterate on that.
Well, that's entrepreneurialism, isn't it?
Yeah.
We take a problem that we find and that we know we can solve, and then we test to see if we can solve it in a way that's profitable.
So what's the most unique thing that you had learned or that you had to deal with, you know, while you're growing your company?
Well, you know, learning to deal with other personalities. So my career really started as a programmer, and programmers are, you know, well known for being smart and intelligent, probably not so well known for being, you know, sociable and good at working with others. So really learning to deal with other folks' expectations, learning how to deal with conflicts, and then also trying to find a winning option in any situation. So, you know, in many situations, everybody wants what they want. They want everything they want. But a lot of times you can whittle those things down and get to something that's agreeable. So finding that middle point, always looking for a win or a way forward for everyone, was a critical factor in keeping the company together, keeping the personalities in the company together, and keeping them all rowing in the same direction.
Is there a time that ever sticks out to you where you think you gave up more than you really wanted to, and you either, you know, it was ended up being good or bad at the end?
Well, yeah, lots of times like that. I would say both exits, I didn't get everything I wanted. Any really good negotiation, I think everybody leaves feeling a little like they could have done a little better. But there were certain critical points that I felt really strongly about that I wasn't going to back down on. And that happened recently in this last deal. It happened in the deal that I did in 2012. There's a certain part where you really got to stick to your guns when you feel like you're deserving of something, regardless of how much rain will fall.
No, fair enough. Good for you for sticking to your guns and having, you know, your walk away points, so to speak.
Well, it'll get you that last $1 million or that last couple hundred thousand. And it even came down to $10,000 on one line item where the guy said, well, this is only $10,000. And I said, I don't know about you, but $10,000 is a lot of money to me.
Yeah.
So I think that's another thing. When you get into these large numbers, you can get decimal dysplasia and not really pay attention to something like $10,000 or $20,000. And that's a huge mistake, because $10,000 is still, even with inflation, a lot of money.
It is. You know, it can cover a lot of your legal fees for the deal, right? Or it can cover, you know, a vacation for you, all sorts of different things. So it definitely adds up.
That's about 5 hours with my lawyer. But
yeah, fair enough. What do you think is an obstacle that, you know, you had to overcome as you're building the business or as you were exiting it, and maybe, you know, dealing with your staff, and I don't want to say having to say goodbye to them or see you later. What's something that you think was a major obstacle that you had to overcome that you learned from?
Well, I did something very creative. And again, I can't talk too much about the deal, but I want to share this part because I think it's important for anyone who's exiting. I shared 10% of the proceeds of the deal, of the profits of the deal, the 10% of the money that I received, with my employees. And I put them along on the earn out with me, right? And so what I would tell you is that, you know, again, everybody's a human being. They all have wants, needs, and desires. And so you have to align your incentives. You can't walk away as someone who's exiting with a huge payout and then leave behind all of the people that got you there with nothing but risk, right? So a big part of growing the company prior to any exit was, one of the hardest things was dealing with people who were with me. You know, I have people that work for me for 13 years, some for 10 years, many for 5+ years. And they had been with me when we were a smaller organization and everything was kind of, what would you say, touch and go. So as we started to formalize and build a management team, and those people couldn't talk to Andrew anymore, they had to talk to a COO or their department head. That was a real challenge because folks were dedicated, they were driven, and they were driven mainly from my leadership. So trying to build the organization away from me was a real challenge, but we were successful in doing that. And it was a lot about hiring the right people and giving them the right direction and how to lead others, right? And then always being kind of overly fair. Finally, aligning incentives. So for example, when our employees would pass the 10-year mark, and we had three of them do it in this last company, we would give them a $10,000 bonus and a 10% raise on their 10th anniversary. And believe me, that's a lot for these folks, and they really appreciated it. But the very first conversation you would hear after that meeting, after we handed out the big funny check, was everybody would be talking about how many years they have and when it's going to be their 10th anniversary. So it's sharing money and sharing incentives, sharing credit for the wins is a huge part about keeping really smart people on board. And that doesn't change when you exit, right? So when I exited, I made sure that I created an incentive structure where everybody benefited along with me. And so you could call any of my employees right now and they would tell you that they loved working with me. They probably would want to work with me again. And I think that's it. You're leaving with a good reputation, leaving where you make people feel valued for their contributions and for their brilliance, not only while you're working with them, but even as you leave, is an important part of building reputation as a world-class leader. I hope I answered your question somewhere in there.
Yeah, you did. Those are some really creative ideas, like $10,000 on the 10-year anniversary, 10% raise. You know, getting people to participate in an earnout so that, you know, even when you're not there, they're still incentivized. All really smart ideas. How did you come up with these, or where did these ideas come from, or where did you read about them?
No, they're all just directly from me. I just came up with them myself. And I guess part of what it is I really love human beings. It's a weird thing to say, but I care very much about my team members and my staff. And I would think, what would make it special for me if I was on the other side? I'm a guy who's making $100,000 a year, or maybe $80,000 a year. Would $1,000 mean anything? You know, so after 10 years of service, if you really look at it, it's $1,000 a year you're giving them for the 10 years of bonus. So it's not an extraordinary amount of money, but it's also getting that time in the conference room where you get the big funny check and everybody applauds and we all have a cake. And those kind of moments, much like birthdays and anniversaries in a marriage, are extremely important. And you have to focus on how other people feel and how you're going to make them feel, you know, part of the team and dedicated to the effort. And so I came up with all of the ideas myself. I have a few others, by the way, that we can share whenever you like.
I'd love to hear a few more of the things that you've tried or things that even haven't worked. But man, you really are bringing that human aspect to the business and really celebrating, you know, what's done and people's accomplishments, which is really huge and so often overlooked. I feel like we can often just get lost in the work and don't celebrate any successes or any wins or even commitment for that matter. And commitment is a huge thing these days.
Well, we had a quarterly meeting as well. We call the Gold Star meeting, where we would get these little gold stars. You can find post-it notes in gold star configuration. And every employee would get 3 stars. We would all come into the conference room, and when they gave a star to another employee, it would mean $20 in cash for that employee. So we would spend an hour or two having a kind of a party, having some food, and then everybody would pass out stars to their teammates. And they would say, you know, Josh really helped me out on this project and I really appreciate you. And the camaraderie that came from, you know, each employee being able to talk about 2 or 3 other employees. And then also somebody ended up with, you know, $1,000 at the end of the day, right? Some of them. But even though that was maybe a few $1,000s a quarter for us to throw those gold star parties, those were incredibly effective at team building and even taking me out of the equation. So, you know, I wasn't handing out the money. It was the employees handing it out to each other. So anytime that you can get employees to recognize each other's achievements independently of yourself, you're literally building a stronger net. You're building a stronger team. And so that was my kind of management thesis through the whole process.
Was that ever modeled to you anywhere, or what, you know, how did you build those character traits to want to establish that type of culture?
It just came from me, Alex, if I'm being honest. I didn't read it or
know anything. Just from your heart.
Yeah, as I said, I care about the people. You know, I'd be honest with you, when I exited this last business, I cried for days over some of the friends that I won't be able to work with anymore. You can still hear it's emotional for me now.
Of course. And, you know, I've known you for a few years now, because we met also, I think, back in 2016 or 2017. And we're at the same graduation for Wharton. And, you know, getting to know you was an incredible experience. And hearing about your successes has just been amazing. And you've grown to be a friend over the years. And so I really appreciate you sharing that and that attachment and connection that you have with people and your colleagues. So thank you for sharing that also.
Well, I have to say I'm kind of attached to you too, Alex.
Well, I appreciate that. So what would you say was one of your biggest successes? Would it be your first exit, your second exit? Like, you know, we're talking about celebrations here. What is a big win for you in your books?
Well, I have to tell you, the real challenge was, and a lot of people don't know this, I was a single father while building these businesses. So raising my son, and he's a wonderful young man, he's in his third year of college, somewhere in there, raising him to be such a great guy was one of my best achievements. That's one of the things I'm most proud of. The money, I think, will come and go. I'm very proud of the businesses I built. It puts a lot of pressure on me now, because now everybody asks me, what are you doing next? I said, I'm thinking is what I'm doing right now. That's my full-time job, is thinking and observing. Because I want to make sure that the next step I take is a very solid step, right? As I like to say, ideas are cheap, but execution is expensive. So let's get a really great idea before we start executing.
For sure.
But yeah, very, very proud of my son. I'm also proud of saving my marriage. My marriage went through some problems and I was able to save that. But the business was like a marathon. That you're running, and or I would say a pie eating contest, and the better you do, the more pie you get. Right. So the answer to winning the pie contest this year was, look, more pie. So that was kind of always running, always something that I was in gear in, and I really enjoyed in doing that. I'd have to give a lot of credit to my teammates too for building that business. The business didn't succeed solely because of me, or even partly because of me. It succeeded 100% because of the team that I built and their work. They were the ones that were doing the work. If as Steve Jobs once said, if you could compare a business to an orchestra, I would be the conductor. I don't play any instruments. I just keep time and keep everyone together.
That's amazing. You have a lot of humility, and I appreciate you sharing and giving credit to everyone on that side of things. I'm sure they will appreciate hearing that as well if they end up listening to the podcast. What's something that you'd want your son to learn or to master? You know, you said he's in the second or third university, and who knows, some Wharton MBAs or Wharton undergrads might listen to this later on. What's something that you think that they should be mastering or thinking about as they, go through the learning experience?
Boy, that's a good one. Well, I think that at least my son could build a little more durability or working harder through challenges, right? I think that a lot of kids that grow up with money and privilege, don't meet really hard challenges. So you're going to get stumbling blocks in your road. You're going to fall down. It's about picking yourself up and getting moving again. So that's one thing. I kind of worry a little bit about the current generation being a little coddled, but I'm sure that's every generation ever has said something to that effect. The second thing is you just don't want your kids to make the same mistakes you did, and no matter how many times you tell them, they just won't listen. they're smarter than you, and now this time it's different. Another thing I wish my son would do a better job listening to his elders. But I know that this is all just a phase in life. I comfort myself with what a great human being he is, and what a great talent he is in school. And then I'm just going to trust the Lord for everything else.
Is there something that sticks out to you now that your parents or grandparents might have said to you about, hey, don't make this mistake. I did this mistake. And then you ended up doing it again. You thought you knew better. Anything that sticks out to you?
Funny thing, it was actually something my grandma said to me when I was very young, like 6. We were doing some math, and then she said, wow, you're always so good at numbers. I've always been impressed with how good you are at this. And that literally stuck with me as something where I always believed I was good at numbers, and then I would work harder when I wasn't. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And so I think those words of encouragement were the most powerful. And so as I raised my child, I worked very hard to encourage and not to criticize. But when they're 19, 21 years old, it's difficult.
I love hearing that. And it's a fine line of trying to figure out, how do you discipline and educate and reinforce things that are really important in your opinion versus, just celebrating, congratulating, and encouraging those things, and what works best and what do they receive. So what is something that I know you said you're going to be thinking, but what's something that you want to be learning about? Because you went to Wharton a few years ago, maybe didn't need to, as you are building a multi-million-dollar business. What made you go to Wharton and decide to start or continue to learn, I should say?
Well, first of all, Wharton is the best, like the best, in my opinion. And I've been there and experienced, and I can come out of that experience and still tell you they're the best. I've been to lots of executive programs. In fact, I just graduated from the Columbia Advanced Management Program last year. But really nothing compares to what you'll receive in the Wharton GMP and AFP programs. You know, what to do next? I'm looking a lot at crypto. I have a lot of crypto as an asset class that I hold on to. It hasn't been a great investment, but I've been adding to it all the way down. So I'm interested in learning about more about blockchain and smart contracts and how that technology can be applied to improve business processes. So that's one area that I'm very interested in. I'm also interested in AI, and I'm thinking about taking some courses at Berkeley for that. But I've already got my class schedule for Wharton out this year, as I'm looking to probably take another online class. The one thing I don't want to do is just sit around. Because the easy way, you know, they say a rolling stone gathers no moss, right? So I don't want to gather any moss. So if I'm not working on something specifically, I think I'm going to really work hard on my continuing education, because staying plugged into those learning communities is where you meet wonderful people, you learn new ideas. I just can't say enough about executive education. So I'll probably be spending some more time in class this year, I would think, while I'm thinking about what to do next.
Well, I'm sure all your classmates and people you encounter are going to be interested in your stories, and hopefully you learn from them and they learn from you as well. If you could go back in time 20 years ago and predict, you know, how your future was going to turn out, how has it turned out like you thought, or how has it turned out completely differently from what you thought it was going to be like?
You know, 20 years ago, I thought, like most 30-year-olds, that, you know, I was going to be a billionaire and the thing was going to take off. And I remember a friend of mine starting a hosting business in 1997, and I kind of laughed at him and said, well, that business is already done. And of course, he exited for like $2 billion a few years ago. So he really did well. You know, but I always thought that this company that I was building would blow up and be huge. What I didn't realize until I went to Wharton some years later is I just didn't have the tools to do that. And I didn't have the expertise in my company to do that. And that, you know, companies like Facebook are like a lottery ticket. There was probably 100 companies, 1,000 companies that had a similar idea. I mean, we can look at MySpace, right? But why did MySpace fail and Facebook succeed, right? So there's a lot to get into being those bigger companies that I didn't realize until I actually went to Wharton, learned the material, kind of learned the rule book of how to run businesses. But 20 years ago, I was sure I'd be a billionaire. I'm not unhappy, though, at all with the way things turned out. There's your vision of what you think will happen, and then there's what happens along the way. And so far, I didn't plan to be a single father at that point. I had a solid relationship and things were going well. It's how you deal with the problems in life and survive through them, I think, that really is the value that you glean in the end of it. So, yep, I'm not a billionaire yet, but I'm working on it.
Love it.
I also have, as now a 53-year-old man, I have a more tempered view of kind of what my expectations should be and what are the steps to getting there, rather than just saying, you know, oh, I'm going to be an NBA player or a billionaire and kind of throw that out there.
Yeah. So, you know, you've been through a lot, as most humans have, or as I want to say, as probably every human has been through their own struggles. What has helped you get through those struggles and overcome some of those obstacles that you've had to face that you've just mentioned?
Well, me personally, I have a lot of faith. I'm a very faith-driven person. That helps me in my darkest times. Just last year, it's been 2 years now, I lost my mother, and that was really, really difficult thing for me to go through. More difficult was dealing with her estate and the beneficiaries in that estate. But how I get through those things is I have family. I have some supportive family. But in the end, you know, you're kind of all alone. You can't really go to your kids or your wife and expect them to pick you up off the ground. At some point, you have to find something within yourself. And so for me, faith is a big part of that, of finding that thing within myself. And also, I just have a good sense of grounding myself when things get too out of control. I also have a way of kind of hoping for the best, but expecting the worst. And this is important because you'll hear people that go through a bad situation and then another bad situation will happen and then another bad situation will happen. And they'll say, gosh, you know, I just wish these bad things would stop happening to me. But you know what? Bad things happen to everyone and you can't stop that. So the question is, what are you going to do with this bad thing, right? How are you going to turn around and react and try to make it into something less bad? Or like you said, like I said before, negotiate some type of win out of this situation. And so that's been a lot of what I've been doing the last 2 years, dealing with people that I haven't talked to in 10 or 15 years over my mother's estate, you know, having to deal with all of that nonsense that goes with processing an estate. But in addition, dealing with my feelings around losing my mother and my father already being gone, and kind of what does that mean for me? You know, who is left to truly care about you after that? And so faith is a big answer for me. But I'm sure everybody has their own sort of gods. And so some people might resort to money and other people might resort to love and relationships. Me, I resort to my faith.
I love that vulnerability and what you just shared there. And you know, this is a topic that I haven't really given much thought to, and I don't know how much people even talk about it, given that I haven't really heard many people talk about it at all, right? Like who's left? Who do you go to for whether it's mentoring or consoling or to talk through you know, your issues or what you're facing in the world? How were your employees, or how did that show up in work at all? Or did you have other mentors that you went through at times? Because I know me and you chatted over the last few years here and there at times over some really, you know, some deep conversations, and we had some deep discussions there. But who else have you been going to when it comes to mentors, and how important do you think a mentor is for people at all ages?
Well, you know, I had a few people that were mentors. I have to say, though, there was a long period there where I was just on my own, right? So there is going to come a time where you're going to be alone, where you're not going to have a mentor, where there won't be somebody to talk to. You know, and I handled it pretty well. I probably drank more than I would have liked to, which is not something. I have an old saying that I'd love to share with everybody. There's no problem that a drink doesn't make worse. So save that one in your quote book. But yeah, where did I end up going? I ended up going to my faith. You really can't go to your employees. Your employees are receiving and you as a leader are transmitting. Okay. And that's a one-way street. I mean, there were a few employees I was friendly with when I might have a short conversation on the side, but I kept it very, very limited. And the reason for that wasn't my role in their life. I'm not a receiver of encouragement. I'm a transmitter of encouragement all the time, right? All the time as a leader. I definitely had some family members that I talked to, but in the end, it was really about talking to myself. It was about exploring the reasons for my emotions, what the motivations were, and it was a long process. But I feel like I've done a very good job, and I'm pretty like 80-90% on the other side of that now, wrapping things up with the estate. So I'm feeling better now about the answers I came back with. And part of the answer was, you know, for my mother anyway, I had talked to my mother a lot about forgiveness before she passed away. And one of my deepest regrets is I know that there was someone in her life that had hurt her badly that she never forgave. And, you know, carrying around those feelings are like carrying stones on your back. Right? When you don't forgive somebody, you're walking around with the stones on your back. And I used to tell her, Mom, just take the stones off your back. Just take them off. And it's easier journey for you. So I was always sad that she never truly forgave that person. But then I came to realize that you know, part of being in control of a business and being in a leader of a family is you feel like you're responsible for everything. As I mentioned with my employees, I'm the transmitter, not the receiver, right? So I had to come to the conclusion that I did everything I could and that she had a responsibility to do what she had to do, and that everything's going to be okay anyway, right? So that's the kind of things that I was working on. It's complex and a long story. You can edit that as you see fit. But to be honest with you, now I'm getting to a point in my life where I realize I'm not responsible for everybody. I'm not responsible for every decision my son makes that's good or bad, or my wife makes. You know, I might be responsible for the cost of their decision, but I'm not responsible for the genesis of it. And so now I'm kind of taking more of a step back, being less controlling, understanding what the limits of my influence are, and also kind of letting myself off the hook when things don't go the way I want them to go.
Interesting thought on limits of your influence. Can you just expand on what you mean by limits of your influence? Because I've given that quite a bit of thought about, you know, how much do I want to influence my kids or, you know, people I work with, and how much do I want to, you know, see what where they naturally digress to and what their innate behaviors are. What made you think about limiting your influence?
Well, when they're younger, I think you really have to influence kids because they don't know right from wrong. They might have some personality traits to drive them to do this or that, but that's definitely training mode. And that's part of what put me in the position that I was now that my son is 20, is I was always used to kind of giving him some direction. I wasn't a tough guy. I had some boundaries, but you know, we have a basic saying in my house, and that is good boys get whatever they want. Bad boys get nothing. Right. So that's kind of the general thing. But as kids get older, especially when they start coming out of their teens, that's when I think you really have to take your foot off the gas and start letting them decide, you know, who they want to be. And so more than telling my son to do something, I would help him inspect the outputs of what he did. So I would say, well, when you act this way, let's look at what the outcome was for that. And so those conversations became more productive, where he had to take responsibility for his outcomes. You know, as far as the limits of influence on employees, I mean, I'm always influencing someone who works for me, or at least trying to. But also I realize that sometimes people are just going to do things that I would never do or never expect them to do. And that happens. And then you have to deal with that, you know? So that too, I realized my limits of influence with people. Whereas if you ask the, you know, 25, 30 year old Andrew, I would have thought it was limitless. You know, mm-hmm. I thought I can influence anybody and make all these things happen, but actually there's quite a few limits.
Yeah, and I asked the question because, you know, sometimes people could have a completely different and arguably even better idea than you might have ever come up with, especially in the business environment. So wanting to, you know, not guide people or direct people too much sometimes, and just seeing what ideas they come up with is a really interesting act that I've been dealing with.
Oh, yeah, that's diversity, I would call that. And I'm a big believer in diversity, you know. When I first started the business, I would start meetings with me speaking for an hour. And then what did you want to say? You know, but by the end of my career, I would just speak for maybe 5 minutes to set the tone. Hey, here's what we're trying to accomplish. And then I would let other people share ideas. And one of the things I would mention is sometimes it's the quietest voices in the room, the people that are the most shy, that don't want to speak up. And those people will have the most brilliant ideas. So you really have to work hard to, you know, kind of pull those ideas out of everybody by creating an environment where they feel comfortable sharing them.
Yeah, no, there was some study that at one of the programs that I went to where they actually talked about the people that are the most quiet, they actually have a higher threshold for accuracy and for being right. And people that speak up easily have a lower threshold, or could have a lower threshold, for just needing to be right. So their ideas might actually be a lot worse. and they just have a different threshold of accuracy. So people that are very quiet could actually have really great ideas, but they're just not 100% sure if they're right or not, so they're not willing to speak up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely seen that.
So how do you pull that out of people? How do you force people to speak? Do you call on people? What do you do?
Well, you know, some people don't like being focused on. So a lot of times I might just go around the group and ask about sharing ideas. But I would find kind of controlling those strong personalities, having more of a dialogue than a lecture is always better. I think I was probably the worst offender. So I was mostly focused on controlling my own behavior and not looking to speak up or tell somebody they were wrong about that or right about this or whatever, just listening to all the feedback. And a lot of times, you know, if you have some feedback that you think is really critical, if you wait 30 seconds, someone else will come up with it. Brilliant minds think alike. You don't have to jump out with every thought or every idea, because mostly the group will come up with similar ideas anyway. So I found that when I quieted down a lot of the things that I might have written down that I was going to say later would be mentioned by somebody else in the group.
Well, Andrew, I appreciate it. You talked a lot about, you know, leadership, employment, incentivization, even parenthood and raising your children and what you've learned along the way. So I really appreciate all the things that you got into and you opening up with us today. So I appreciate it. Is there anything else you want to add to this conversation or share?
No, just, you know, Alex, thank you so much for making me part of this community. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak and share thoughts with so many people. And of course, I just look forward to participating and supporting the alumni group in any way that I can. So please don't hesitate to ask if there's something I can do.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being on today.
All right, brother. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.